Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll revisit the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival with an excerpt from Reading in the Digital Age, my panel with novelist Michael Cunningham and critics Maureen Corrigan and Dwight Garner. We'll also talk with Peg Phelps of the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library book sale. Today, we're revisiting the Reading in the Digital Age panel from the 2013 Tennessee Williams Festival. That panel took place with Maureen Corrigan, Michael Cunningham, and Dwight Garner. Maureen Corrigan is the book critic for NPR's Fresh Air, and she's the author of the delightful reading memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She's the critic in residence at Georgetown University and writes about mysteries for the Washington Post. She's currently at work on a book about F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby and why it is the great American novel. Michael Cunningham is the author of A Home at the End of the World, Specimen Days, By Nightfall, Flesh and Blood, as well as the Pulitzer Prize and Pen Faulkner winner, The Hours. He is presently teaching at Yale University, and he generously served as the judge for the Tennessee Williams Festival's fiction contest this year. Dwight Garner is a book critic for the New York Times, and he's been a senior editor for the New York Times Book Review. He was the founding books editor of Salon.com. He is the author of Read Me, A Century of Classic American Book Advertisements, and he is at work on a biography of James Agee. We began by talking about how and where we read.
I think for me, and probably for my fellow panelists, reading is like breathing. And any time that I'm not in the classroom or making dinner or walking the dog, I probably have a book in my hand. And with my husband and daughter, I live in a tiny row house in Washington, D.C. So in terms of where I read, it's sort of wherever the dog or my daughter or my husband isn't, you know, reading or watching TV. I don't really have a special place. It's just the whole house is filled with books. I get probably these days about 200 books a week delivered to my home from publishers, review copies sent to my home. So the house is filled with books. For a reader, it's the candy store. For everybody else, it's a nightmare. So,
tell us what your plumber said.
Oh, we had a leaky basement problem in our row house some years ago. And one of these waterproof basement guys who came to give us an estimate looked around and said something like, well, I bet you they didn't teach you about waterproofing basements when you were in grad school. Meaning he looked at all these books and he sort of had that attitude that, in fact, relatives of mine have, which is, where does this get you, all this reading? What's the payoff? You know, here you are in this cramped house with a leaky basement. You think you're hot stuff. I'm writing out an estimate for $10,000 to waterproof your basement. It's that anti-reading, anti-intellectual attitude that I encounter a lot. I think we definitely have a healthy strain of that in America.
What about you, Dwight?
Well, one of the great occupational hazards of reading all the time, which I do, is that you tend to get yourself quite, you know, you light a fire and make some tea and find a nice place to read, and then 20 minutes later, you're fast asleep, no matter how good the book is. So I tend now to read sitting up at a table. It's just, I find it's more conducive to thought. I just, you know, when I'm reading for pleasure, I'll go lie down on the couch, but it's nice to get the work done and the book read.
So, Michael, where do you read? How much do you read?
Where do I read? How much do I read? A lot and pretty much everywhere. Yeah, I mean, I've always got a book with me. Mm-hmm. I live in New York, which means, like, everybody in New York, I carry a giant rucksack with me at all times. It's like we're all on camping trips, which makes it quite easy to be carrying one or two or even three books at a time, just when I find myself on the subway.
Well, those of you who know me well know that I have an upstairs book, a downstairs book, an upstairs bathroom book, a downstairs bathroom book, a carpool book. So they're just everywhere, and I do read as if it were breathing, as I think most of us do. But we've reached this time of great and incredible change with the advent of e-readers, and I remember standing up at my retirement party at the Times-Picayune, wobbling a little bit and going, and I can promise you people, I will never buy a Kindle. And a friend of mine in the back row said, "What has she got against candles?" And the following Christmas, my relatively new beau gave me a Kindle for Christmas, and everybody looked at him and said, "Do you know her? Do you know her?" So dragged kicking and screaming into the whatever century we're in, but. Dwight, this panel was partly inspired by a wonderful piece you wrote about the way we read now. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that piece.
Well, the piece I did for the Times was just trying to accept the reality that e-reading is here, whether we like it or not. And there have been so many great arguments against electronic reading. I mean, I think Nicholson Baker called it, I think, the Bowflex of literacy or something, some expensive thing you buy to guilt yourself into reading more books, which is just a great observation. But lately, I've read some quite interesting arguments for electronic reading. Tim Parks in the New York Review of Books basically thinks that it's a more serious way to read. He's argued that no dictator can burn an e-book. He thinks it offers a more austere engagement with words. My personal take is somewhere in between those two. I read online and offline. I will just comment on Michael's rucksack notion. One of the big nightmares about e-readers in New York City right now is that they've ruined the sort of fleeting crushes you would have on great people with their great books, reading them in the subway. Now every young woman and man and old woman and old man has a Kindle, and you don't know what people are reading. And the spread of viral ideas, I think, is just damaged by that in some way.
Hmm. And they're not all reading 50 Shades of Grey on this panel. They can't possibly be. Now, Maureen and Michael and I had this really remarkable experience of being in the very small reading group that judged the Pulitzer in 2012. And one of the interesting things was hearing Michael reading from all over the world, because he would call in when we would have our teleconferences and talk about reading books on his iPad and having books shipped here and there. And what was that like for you, Michael, to read that many books in different ways?
Yeah, I was traveling for a few months during a period in which I had about 200 books to read, and so I bought an iPad, having thought, I don't really want an iPad. And although I still love a physical book, I almost immediately thought, oh, a magic little box that lights up and will tell you any story in the world. Oh, yeah, like something you would give a sultan so that he wouldn't destroy your village. I thought, this is magic too. I don't think it's one or the other. I think there will always be books. There will always be bookstores. People will always want to be among other people looking at books. And then sometimes, I need to read the new Zadie Smith right now. And it's midnight. And there it is.
Michael confessed to loving the immediacy of his iPad.
Can I throw in one more thing in praise of internet reading? My novel, The Hours, which is based on Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway. One of the most popular questions was, do I have to have read Mrs. Dalloway first? And I was actually very eager not to produce a book that required familiarity with a previous book. However, there are things going on in The Hours that will make sense if you've read Mrs. Dalloway, and if you happen to want to spend your time reading that particular potboiler, in the internet version, you can check the references. You can see how it connects to Mrs. Dalloway without, God forbid, having to actually read Mrs. Dalloway. But you know what I mean? There's that, too. There's that sense that fiction is full of illusions and underlayers, and maybe Norse myth and the late works of Henry James are not immediately familiar to you, but being able to hit that little thingy and have it explained to you, therefore deepening the meaning of the novel you're reading, what's not to like about that?
Yeah. And Dwight Garner had some praise for his iPhone.
I personally think the iPhone is the greatest thing for literacy since Gutenberg. I mean, now you're no longer stuck in that worst of all situations somewhere with nothing to read. I mean, the DMV or the dentist's office, now, thanks to this machine, you can read anything in the world at the drop of a hat, which is just extraordinary. I wrote in my piece that I think among the founding fathers, Ben Franklin would have liked this device because he's the founding father who said, read much but not too many books. Which I like, but I tried to read. It occurred to me I own sort of all these devices now, and I sort of was thinking that for the iPad, for example, it's a good place to skim things. And the kind of big biographies like the Steve Jobs bio I had on there for a while, and it sort of felt conducive to that. The one thing that I didn't cotton to reading online at all was poetry. It just didn't work for me. Something about the solitude, something about the white space. It just didn't work out. The one poem I said was excellent reading online, however, was Clive James's classic poem called "The Book of My Enemy Has Been Remaindered, and I Am Glad." And one of the reasons I loved it is that he talks about the joy of seeing his enemy's book in a remainder bin, and it made me wonder what our remainder bins will look like when we no longer have them. I mean, it's an issue now about used e-books is a big issue in the publishing world.
We all talked a bit about the difficulty of finding time to read.
Do you feel it in yourself when you read these things? I know when I read on the Kindle, I read too quickly. It's too easy. And I tried to read Jane Eyre on the Kindle when I couldn't find my copy, and I had a lot of trouble reading it because the words weren't where I was used to them being. I was used to them in a certain place in the book, and I was totally rattled by this. So how are you all finding your attention spans in that and in the reading you do for pleasure as well as for work?
Wow. I don't know. I don't think my attention span has declined yet. I'm sure it's right over the horizon.
What was the question?
Yeah, right. Yeah. What were we talking about? It's always... Reading is also always the great prize that I'm trying to grasp, to have enough hours in the day to sort of find a place to nestle into and read a book uninterrupted for a few hours. That's why I try to get up early most days, so that I have that time before all the electronic devices start beeping and the phone starts ringing and everybody's running around trying to find the house keys, just to have that quiet time. So I don't think it's chipped away yet at my attention span.
Yeah, I feel like mine is about, like everybody, I feel like I haven't read enough.
Yeah.
And I read all the time, and yeah. I still feel like I have, barely educated. And I do sometimes think about how if, say we could conjure, Thackeray, and he was introduced to all of us. Oh, and this is Michael Cunningham. He is a novelist who's actually gotten as far as being on this panel. He doesn't know the King James Bible. He has read no French or Russian novels in the original because he does not read French or Russian. Thackeray would be, I would wager, far more dismayed about us than we are about 15-year-olds.
Yeah, that's a good point.
What about you, Dwight?
Sorry, what was the question?
Attention span.
Attention span. my pocket's beeping. I actually am the kind of writer who I tend to leave my email and texts, and when I'm writing, I tend to, it beeps every couple of minutes, as we all know, and I find that it works well enough. You would think that, I don't know if Michael, if you just try to find a safe room and have no outside input, or either one of you, but I kind of enjoy the small breaks from my writing anyway, and I find that I can get back into it. But reading is the big problem. Reading books, if your email's beeping, it just takes you out, and it's hard to find the right kind of zone, to read deeply and read well.
Well, I wonder, do you feel the same way? I mostly love this stuff, though I have found that I have developed a sense that if I get a beep, that means that there's an email or text. Mm-hmm. I have to check it.
Right, right.
Yeah. I have to because it's just part of the deal.
Yeah.
I have to respond immediately, and that I try to discourage in myself. Mm-hmm. I said no, don't even look and see who it was.
Right.
Yeah.
But it might be the MacArthur Committee,
Well,
that's what I'm always
exactly.
thinking. What's
and,
that?
And of course, if you don't pick up, they give the MacArthur to somebody
yes,
else.
That's right.
I work for a newspaper, and so I feel sort of beholden. I feel like I have to check my email. The morning I told these people last night, but the morning I arrived here, I was set to go to Felix's and eat my first oysters, and I got the call that Chinua Achebe had died, and the Times needed an appreciation from me in 3 hours, and you know I had to go write it in a hotel room. But that's just the way it works, doing what I do for a living. So I feel like I have to be plugged in to some degree.
And you should look up that obituary, because it is a really lovely piece of writing. And now you know it was done under pressure, great pressure.
After one Dixie beer.
And Michael had some consolation for those of us who worry about outdated technology.
Here's a fun fact. somewhere in the vast complex of the Smithsonian Institution, somebody is storing every model of computer so that data that can only be read on a computer that became extinct 20 years ago remains legible. So somebody is, you know, God bless Washington, D.C. for taking care of us once again.
Maureen gave us a premiere of her work in progress about F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby.
I've read Gatsby over 50 times. I've taught it all my life in college. I really am fascinated by the fact that Gatsby is the great American novel that most educated Americans have read. Someone did a survey about 10 years ago and found that Gatsby is the one novel that if you're teaching freshman English, you can expect that about 80% of your students will have read coming into college. And after that, it absolutely fragments. Mm-hmm. Catcher in the Rye, To Kill a Mockingbird, Huckleberry Finn, all over the place. But Gatsby is the one novel, partly because it's short. So it's assigned in high school. I'm fascinated by what we find in Gatsby, how it defines us, if it does, as Americans. And I'm also fascinated by the story of how America came to recognize Gatsby as a great American novel. When Fitzgerald died in 1940, his last royalty check was for $13.13. He was 44 years old. Everything that he had written effectively was out of print. Scribner still had some copies of Gatsby in the warehouse that had been moldering there since 1925. So how do we go from that in 1944 to the present where, well, we've got the new Gatsby movie coming out. Gatsby is in pretty much every high school classroom, at least honors English classroom. People know it even if they haven't read it. How does that happen? That's what I'm exploring in my book.
And those are some highlights from the Tennessee Williams Festival panel with Maureen Corrigan, Michael Cunningham, and Dwight Garner. Can't wait to see what next year's festival brings.
Gotta keep reading, 'cause this book's gonna be a good book. 'Cause this book's gonna be a good book. 'Cause this book's gonna be a good, good book to read. 'Cause this book's gonna be a good book. 'Cause this book's gonna be a good book. 'Cause this book's gonna be a good, good book to read.
Pick up that book and turn the page. You'll never know just what you'll find. Information or fantasy, drama and art, all make you smart.
When I think of bookstores and libraries, I usually think of the special people associated with them. And when I think of the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library book sale, I think of Peg Phelps. Peg grew up in New York, New Jersey, and Virginia, and moved to New Orleans in 1971. After she retired from her work as a computer programmer, she embarked on a Master of English program here at the University of New Orleans. And when she graduated in 1995, after writing her thesis on Faulkner, she got involved with the Friends of the Library book sale. Welcome to the Reading Life, Beg.
Thank you.
So what drew you to this particular form of volunteerism?
Well, I always loved books. As a young child, I think as soon as I learned to read, I was taken to the library by my parents, and I just fell in love with books. And book lovers are wonderful people, too. And selling used books to people who need to buy them at a lower price and putting the money back into the library seems to me also to be the perfect recycling project.
Isn't it? I kind of love that, too. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is that the work for all these things, Friends of the New Orleans Public Library Book Sale, Friends of the Jefferson Parish Public Library Book Sale, and Symphony Book Fair, this work goes on all year round.
Yes, we work every Tuesday and Thursday from 9 to 1, and our sorting center is now located at the East Bank Regional Library on West Napoleon in Metairie. So it is definitely a year-round project. We accept donations, and we price and pack books all year round.
And you sell books online as well, don't you?
Yes. In the summer of 2006, one of our new volunteers set up an online selling system for us through Amazon.com. And it has grown and grown to the point where we probably net as much from the Amazon sales as we would at a book sale.
Now, one of the things that people in the used book business tell me is that you see books that you've never seen before and you might never see again. So what are some of the treasures that have come through your book sale?
Well, right after I finished at UNO, I was looking to get a complete copy of Faulkner's books. And there were two of his books that were very hard to find in the United States because they were only being published in England at the time. And that was Pylon and Soldier's Pay, both of which, by the way, Faulkner wrote when he lived here in New Orleans in the 20s. And I found a copy of Soldier's Pay just sorting through paperbacks, and I just could not believe it. It was the find of the year for me. As far as books that we sell to other people, we did find an old copy that we really were planning to throw away. It was so old, of some kind of a petroleum book that turned out to be very valuable, and we did sell that online through our Amazon section.
Wow. So do volunteers get first dibs?
Well, if we find something, we can buy it, if, you know, a reasonable number of books. Of course, we have to pay the price that everybody else would have to pay.
Of course.
You know, the other thing that's very interesting is we see a lot of out-of-print books. And just seeing all these books that, for instance, that I had to go through interlibrary loan to get when I was at UNO in order to use them for term papers. And there they were, you know, coming in these boxes. It's just amazing what we get. It's almost like a treasure hunt.
And you've had some amazing experiences going to people's homes as well and picking up books, haven't you?
We really have. I remember one box of books that we got. The books looked really old and, you know, well-worn. But when we started to go through them, there was, I think, a first edition Faulkner and a first edition Hemingway and a first edition Fitzgerald, I think. So you just never know what you're going to find in those boxes.
Oh, what treasures. And how does the library spend the money? How is this money directed?
Well, the way we ask them to spend it is on items that they would not normally be able to purchase with the budget that they get from Jefferson Parish. So they spend it for all kinds of different things. They spend it for books that they just couldn't cover with their budget. They might spend it for furniture. They did buy a lot of furniture after Katrina with the money from our sales. They are buying a lot of DVDs and a lot of ebooks. And we have a pretty extensive summer reading program at the Jefferson Public Library, too. And they do use the money we give for the little prizes that they give out to the kids for reading.
So tell us the details of this event coming up.
Okay. It's April the 11th through the 14th, Thursday through Sunday. And on the weekdays and Saturday, the hours are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. And on Sunday from noon to 5 p.m., The sale is at the Pontchartrain Center, which is at 4545 Williams Boulevard in Kenner. So if you go all the way toward the lake on Williams Boulevard, right before you fall into the lake, turn left, and that's the Pontchartrain Center. And we do have free admission and free parking. We expect to have approximately 65,000 used books, tapes, DVDs, CDs, records for sale.
Wow. And there'll be lots of friendly volunteers there staffing the sale.
Yes.
And for more information, you can call Friends of the Library at 504-455-2665 or email friendsjpl@yahoo.com. Thanks so much, Peg.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Novelist Pam Houston reads from Contents May Have Shifted, Tuesday, April 9th at 7 p.m. at the Collins Hotel. That's part of the 1718 reading series. Michelle Hirstius signs Juju the Good Voodoo, Wednesday, April 10th at 7 p.m. at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Today's guest, Peg Phelps, will be around at the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library Big Book Sale. That's April 11th through 14th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, that's April 11th through 13th from 10 to 8, Sunday, April 14th from noon to 5. There will be more than 65,000 gently used books, puzzles, DVDs, CDs, videotapes, music tapes, and records for sale. For more information, call Friends of the Library at 504-455-2665 or email friendsjpl@yahoo.com. Emily Clark signs A Strange History of the American Quadroon, Free Women of Color in the Revolutionary Atlantic World, Thursday, April 11th at 3:30 at the Louisiana State Museum's 1850 House. Poet Brenda Marie Osby reads from History and Other Poems, Thursday, April 11th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Gina Myers and Nasimiyu Marumba read at 8 p.m. Thursday, April 11th at the Goldmine Saloon as part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. Lorraine Johnson signs Later Tartan Gator Friday, April 12th at 7 p.m. at Barnes & Noble Metairie and Saturday, April 13th at 1 p.m. at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Johnette Downing signs How to Dress a Po' Boy Saturday, April 13th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Cecily White signs Prophecy Girl Saturday, April 13th at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. Kid Chef Eliana signs Cool Kids Cook Louisiana Saturday, April 13th at 3 at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Louisiana State Poet Laureate Julie Kane presents a reading Sunday, April 14th at 3 p.m. at the New Orleans Museum of Art. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, April 14th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. William Kent Kruger signs Ordinary Grace, Monday, April 15th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Stuart Wood signs Unintended Consequences, Tuesday, April 16th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. And warmest congratulations to Larry Powell, author of The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans. It was named Book of the Year by the Louisiana Historical Association, and it received the Kemper and Lila Williams Prize from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Bravo! And last weekend at the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities Annual Awards Luncheon, The Accidental City shared Humanities Book of the Year honors with Ben Sandmel's Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans. Way to go. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.